Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Look at it this way. You could be a tax collector in Greece. The latest on the debt impasse coming up. Also, a chat with Judd Apatow from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In St. Paul today, the studios of Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. You know, you've got your sexy parts of business in the economy, the hot high-tech startup or the big banking deal. We all know those. And then you've got the not-so-sexy bits, the boring stuff. Yet, sometimes the stuff without which we, in this instance, might all go hungry. There's been a fair amount of merger news the past couple of days involving food companies. A federal judge has put the kibosh on a proposed deal between wholesale distribution giants Sysco and U.S. Foods. And meanwhile, two big European grocery chains with sizable operations here in the States have announced they are going to hook up. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at why all the would-be partnering.
Critics feared restaurants, hotels, and hospitals would have a harder time price shopping for supplies if Sysco and U.S. Foods merged.
They're distributing to some smaller players who don't have any market potential pricing power with them.
That's Brian Boer, a professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota. But Aaron Lash, an analyst with Morningstar, thinks critics, including the FTC, are not looking closely enough at what big food distributors are up against. Lash says Sysco has a lot of competition from places like specialty produce or seafood retailers.
Struggling restaurants have also looked to club and wholesale stores to fulfill their needs, as well as online options.
But that argument about stiff competition is maybe easier to make in the retail food world, where two grocery chains, Ahold and Delhaize, now want to team up. The firms are based in Europe, but generate a big chunk of their sales in the U.S., particularly on the East Coast. Ahold has the Stop and Shop and Giant chains, and Delhaize has Food Lion and Hannaford.
One of the kind of defining characteristics of the food landscape in the U.S. is this enormous level of fragmentation.
Mike Paglia is director of retail insights with Kantar Retail. He says food retailers are trying hard to differentiate themselves from each other.
Dollar stores are all about super low price points. The Whole Foods of the world really focus in on organics and a really premium in-store experience.
Paglia doubts Ahold and Delhaize would stand out much better together in that landscape, though a merger would help cut costs. Analysts say a combined firm would make it one of the top five grocery chain operators in the U.S., probably not big enough to draw a ton of regulatory scrutiny. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
One hesitates to use the phrase kick the can down the road flippantly, but that is, in fact, what's going on over in Brussels with what one can only hope are the end stage negotiations of the interminable Greek debt crisis. European finance ministers cut short a meeting today. They are going to give it another go tomorrow, perhaps. Christine Lagarde, the head of the International Monetary Fund, says the current Greek offer relies too much on raising tax revenue. That's something that has not been an economic strength for Athens of late. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been in Greece reporting on stories of ordinary people there and how they are just doing their jobs and trying to get by. And today, not coincidentally, the tax collector. Here you go.
For Maria Papadopoulou, the crisis may well take a turn for the worse. She's a tax collector. She'll be required to raise more revenue. No easy task when you consider what she and her colleagues already face from the reluctant taxpayers of Athens.
Physical threats, swearing, spitting, and at some point they even try to grab you. We have that in a daily basis.
There are no security guards in her tax collection office. She and her colleagues have to deal with the more violent and threatening taxpayers themselves.
They threaten you, your mother, your family. This is the way of expressing their anger and their depression.
Maria admits this is not her dream job.
It's an underpaid and difficult job.
Why do you do it?
To have insurance and steady paycheck.
Hatred of tax collectors hits the humblest officials and the highest. Harry Theoharis became the Greek equivalent of the head of the IRS 2 years ago, his mission to crack down on evasion. His office got calls saying it would only cost 5,000 euros to have his legs broken. Today he plays down the threat.
The police always assessed it, and they assessed it as not an organized thing.
Nobody's actually going to come after you and break your legs.
Hopefully.
But Theoharis quit the agency only 17 months into a five-year term. He couldn't stand the intense political pressure to lay off investigating well-connected individuals.
Those things would increase more and more. And instead of actually doing my job, I would have to deal with those kind of pressures on a daily basis.
The fate of Harry Theoharis was no surprise to Aristides Hatzis, professor of law and economics at Athens University.
He was very good at his job, so his behavior annoyed a lot of people, especially powerful, economically and politically powerful people.
Cronyism and corruption have further undermined the willingness of millions of ordinary Greeks to pay their taxes, as tax collector Maria Papadopoulou knows only too well from the tax dodgers she deals with every day.
Even though I don't justify them, their actions, I can understand the way they think.
Under pressure from its creditors, Greece raised an extra $1 billion in tax revenue last year. But it's estimated that more than $50 billion is owed in unpaid back taxes. The tax collectors have a long way to go. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Wednesday, yeah, we've seen better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's rare indeed in the world of medicine to find a way to improve health and at the same time save money, which is why there's a growing focus in healthcare today on the idea that spending a little on social services now might be a way to head off spending a lot on medical care later. We've been unpacking that idea a little bit this week. So from our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein wraps up our series with this. How the social interventions that make people healthier can seem so simple but can be so tough to pull off.
How do you treat people who are extraordinarily sick?
My name is Evelyn Powell. I'm 68 years old. I have emphysema. I got arrhythmic heart failure. Got asthma.
Powell runs a rooming house in Portland, Oregon. She's one of those patients that healthcare people call frequent flyers.
I was in and out of the hospital all the time. It would be a month, a whole month. I'd be in the hospital three or four times.
In that label, frequent flyers, you hear something pejorative. It's certainly easy to judge Powell. She struggled to keep track of her meds. She ate lousy food. And she kept smoking. Physician assistant Cassie Ryan-Mapolsky sees plenty of patients like Powell at her Portland clinic. Sooner or later, she says, you just get stuck.
There can be those moments where you're like, I don't know what else to do for you. Why are you here? What do you want? What do you want me to do? I have no way to help you. I have no way to help you help yourself.
In virtually every city and town in America, there are men and women who can't keep up with their chronic illnesses like diabetes and congestive heart failure. In virtually every city and town in America, there are doctors and nurses who believe poverty, mental illness, and addiction are at the root of the problem. These are among the most expensive patients in the healthcare system, and their ranks are growing. Under the Affordable Care Act, more people at the margins are getting insurance through Medicaid, says Harvard's Dr. Ashish Jha.
If you were homeless and had a lot of healthcare needs in the past, you often couldn't access healthcare, and that would mean you would get sicker and you would often die. Today, we have a lot more people coming into the healthcare system. Insurance expansion has meant that a lot of these people can thankfully get healthcare.
And that means the cost to taxpayers for prescriptions, ambulance rides, and week-long hospital stays just keep climbing. But unlike costs for people at the end of life or battling cancer, these costs, at least on paper, could be reduced or even avoided if people got better care. The consulting firm Oliver Wyman says delivering proper care to these patients nationwide could save $300 billion a year. The question, of course, is what proper care looks like.
We should get in the pool because I think lots of people are coming after school, so we should get in there before it gets too crowded.
What's happening this afternoon at the Dishman Community Center in Portland may be part of the answer. Social worker Lisa Perlstein leads her patient client Tony Horst toward the pool. He's a little nervous. He hasn't been swimming in 15 years.
It might be hard on me. It might be not hard. I hope I don't have chest pains in the swimming pool.
Tony has a heart problem. He's got to lug around an oxygen tank. Tony also has a lot of anxiety. The fact that he showed up at all after getting lost on his way here is because of the relationship he's built with Perlstein. Tony is part of the Health Resilience Program run by Care Oregon, an insurance company covering Medicaid patients. Under the program, people like Perlstein seek out the whole picture of a person. She asks about their priorities, their worries, and their pain. That's crucial to developing the kind of trust that she's built with Tony.
This population of people have been impacted by so much hell. It's overwhelming sometimes.
It may be overwhelming and time-consuming, but Care Oregon believes getting to know patients so intimately helps it do a better job. For example, the company has realized not all poor patients with chronic illnesses are the same. Some are able to manage their disease and don't cycle in and out of the hospital. Those who do are often socially isolated, like Joanne McVeigh. She's married, but her husband's gone a lot, and she's really sick.
Diabetes, OCD, PTSD, panic and anxiety attacks, asthma, sleep apnea, plantar fasciitis.
Care Oregon's approach to isolation is to pair patients like Joanne with a social worker and a peer who has similar lived experiences. Joanne tells me about one day earlier this spring, stuck in her studio apartment at the Sandy Motel with her feet and knee driving her nuts.
I was really frustrated and I was really in pain.
She couldn't make headway with the doctor and she felt her anxiety spooling up inside.
I was emotionally feeling like I wanted to get to the hospital. I wanted to take pills. I was crying. It set my bipolar in. I wanted to throw things.
Joanne was this close to calling the ambulance, but instead started scrolling through her phone.
And I found Sam. She's got, you know, her stuff. I got my stuff. And it's just easy to talk to her. I can just be myself and explode.
Sam Osborne, Joanne's peer support, also diagnosed with bipolar disorder, came over and they talked. Catastrophe averted. No 911, no ambulance, no ER admission. Care Oregon knows it still needs better data, but building relationships and reaching the socially isolated seems to be paying off. 2.5 years since the program launched, the company says it's cut hospital and ER admissions by 35%. Part of that is people like frequent flyer Evelyn Powell want to avoid the hospital and the ER. Working with Care Oregon, Powell quit smoking, has a better handle on her meds, and has stayed out of the hospital since January. Stories like this lead many in the industry to believe improving health and saving money is possible and the only measure of success. But some, like Care Oregon's Lisa Perlstein, wonder if that's right.
We could do everything, and still people are going to struggle. It's just, poverty is so profound. Trauma is so profound.
Perlstein tells me about Bop, a 50-something woman addicted to heroin for more than 30 years, in and out of an abusive relationship, in chronic pain.
I don't even know what was wrong with her physically. We had a standing appointment. She would show up on Monday morning at 9:30. I could see her get off the bus, and would be able to tell if she was high or not.
Perlstein says while they worked together for a couple of years, Bop kept going into the hospital and the ER about the same as always. Bop stayed on the streets until Perlstein helped get her into hospice.
And she didn't die on the street. I'm going to get off. She died in her sister's home in a bed. With treatment, she wasn't in pain. She died with dignity. She didn't just fall down, face down in the street in the gutter and get picked up and taken to an emergency room where nobody knew her.
No one ever saved any money on Bop, but she died the way she wanted. Maybe that's enough. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Dan's story was produced for us with support from the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships. They are at USC Annenberg back in L.A. Coming up.
Every once in a while you listen to a new band or a new song and you instantly go, I love this. What is this? That's how I feel with comedians.
And then he makes him a star, Judd Apatow, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Industrial's off 178 points today, about 0.9%, closed at 17,966. The NASDAQ declined 37 points, 0.7%, 5,122. The S&P 500 dropped 15.7% there as well, ended at 2108. Not a great showing for banks today. Goldman Sachs lost 1.8%. Bank of America gave back 1% today. We told you about Sysco and U.S. Foods. Sysco rose 3% today. That decision triggered a sell-off for other companies looking to merge. If you remember, Staples wants to buy rival Office Depot for $6 billion in change, a merger that still needs regulatory approval. Staples wilted nearly 4%. Today, Office Depot cut 2.4%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. So to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for May. The House Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on nuclear deterrence in the 21st century. And 77 years ago, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was signed into law. It set a national minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. The federal minimum wage today is $7.25. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're getting down to the wire with the Supreme Court this term. Among the major cases still pending with the justices is King versus Burwell, the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act. At issue are the health care subsidies that some people get from the federal government if they live in states that didn't set up their own exchanges. There is potentially a whole boatload of political and economic angst going to happen when that decision comes down, or maybe there won't be. It depends on which way the decision goes, right? But either way it does go, entrepreneurs are betting that healthcare exchanges are still ripe for a little bit of disruption. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
I've left stuffy Washington and headed out to a technology park in Reston, Virginia. It's nice to hear birds singing for a change. I'm here to see Sanjay Singh.
Hey, Sanjay.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Singh is CEO and co-founder of HCentiv, a tech startup that supplies the software for state healthcare exchanges. HCentiv helped Kentucky and New York set up their exchanges, two of the more glitch-free state marketplaces. Singh is a political junkie and a techie. He got immersed in hearings on the Affordable Care Act and read through the nearly 1,000-page bill, the first bill he ever read.
There shall be appropriated to the secretary out of any monies in the treasury.
Singh made a bet, establishing HCentiv before the Affordable Care Act even became law. Now he's making another bet. If the Supreme Court rules that people in states using the federal exchanges to buy their insurance aren't eligible for subsidies, he'll be ready with what he's calling an exchange in a box, a ready-made answer for states that suddenly need to build their own marketplaces.
Many times you can take what has been already built, package it in a way that a state can use it almost out of the box.
HCentiv says its exchange in a box can be up and running in under 6 months. Singh says there wouldn't be any big upfront down payment. States could pay HCentiv a percentage of the fee they charge to insurers. There is one big unknown for Singh: politics. David K. Jones is an assistant professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. He says 26 state legislatures won't even be in session this summer.
Kind of what? How will a state even decide it wants to do an exchange in the box? How will they get the legislation passed? Will it require a governor being brave enough to do an executive order.
It's hard to tell how governors in red states that now rely on the federal exchange would react. Some campaigned hard against the Affordable Care Act and government involvement in health care. But Singh thinks they may be more open to a private sector solution, like his exchange-in-a-box. Joel Aereo says Singh may be on to something. Aereo was the first director of the federal exchange. Now he's managing director at Manat Health Solutions.
If I'm a governor in one of the red states, I'm going to be concerned about making some kind of arrangement with the federal government to basically run my exchange. But I'm going to be more open to a private company.
So Sanjay Singh, the political junkie, could bridge a political divide and make a profit in the process.
An American health benefit exchange.
In Reston, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Were I to mention the name Judd Apatow, you'd think maybe the TV show Freaks and Geeks, maybe the movies Knocked Up or Bridesmaids, or maybe even HBO's Girls. Apatow is a producer, a writer, a director, also a comedian who's got a very, very long IMDb page. But his comedy career has its roots back farther even than that. As a high schooler, he started his own radio show as a way to get a foot in the door to interview actual real-life comedians and figure out how they do what they do. Those conversations and some others he's recorded since then are part of a new book he's got out. It's called Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. Judd Apatow, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
You got to give me the backstory to this thing. You're 14, 15 years old.
Yes.
You're on Long Island. You want to be a comedian. And you say to yourself, I'm going to go interview a bunch of comedians on how to be a comedian.
Well, back then, you know, there was no internet. There were no podcasts. There was no way to listen to a comedian talk about how to do it. Unless you were going to go to the public library and look up some microfiche interview from somewhere. The times were different. So I thought, oh, the only way I could ask a comedian how to be a comedian would be to start this radio show for my high school radio station where I interviewed comedians.
And it works, which is the bananas part of this thing.
Well, back then, I think no one asked comedians to do interviews. I think if you were Gary Shandling and you were a young comedian hosting The Tonight Show every once in a while, the phone didn't ring that much.
Yeah.
So when I would call their publicist, they would say yes. So they look like good publicists getting an interview for their comedian client. And I never told anyone I was from a high school. So it was an elaborate ruse.
You have now become, I guess by virtue of longevity, right, a mentor to a whole lot of people in this business. Were you ready for that?
I never thought of it in those terms, but I like it. Like, people were nice to me, like Gary Shandling and James Brooks, and they really taught me everything that I know when I worked on their shows. And to me, it's the natural part of this, which is you always need help. So if I am working on a show like Freaks and Geeks, I need a staff. And sometimes I have young writers on the staff, and they're really talented, but they don't know how to do it yet. And part of my job is to teach them how to do it. So it makes my job easier. So mentorship is something that pays off for them, but it makes my life easier. If, you know, the stronger Amy Schumer is writing Trainwreck, the earlier I can go to bed at night.
Huh. Do you know reasonably quickly on meeting somebody or seeing their stuff that they're going to be funny? I mean, you say in this book that you know Adam Sandler was going to be a star as soon as you met him.
I think it's like a band. Every once in a while you listen to a new band or a new song, and you instantly go, I love this. What is this? That's how I feel with comedians. I'll see someone, and maybe right away I just think, I love this person. I wish they had a movie. And if they don't have a movie, my job is to help them make a movie. Because in comedy, we love discovering a new person. We love discovering Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover, even though he's already a veteran, but most people didn't know him. And and when you see someone who's great for the first time, it's really exciting. And that's the moment I like working with people. I like introducing new people to the audience.
There's a school of thought that goes that comedy comes from pain, right? Good comedy comes from pain. You know, you had a tough upbringing. Your parents got divorced. But you say it's at some point in this book, you're talking to, I think, Jimmy Fallon. And you say, yeah, I wonder if I'm too far from my pain now to be funny anymore.
Yeah, I think about that. But then I realize... I think I have enough. I should feel better right now. I generally, I think whatever your original neuroses and pain, whatever wound you're trying to heal, it takes your entire life to get it figured out. I think success in a lot of ways only makes you feel worse because you think, wow, that didn't even work. And then the ambulance comes
and
to take me away.
And then the ambulance goes by. That's right. That's right.
That's why you could be nervous That's the rest right. of your life because you know one day you're going to be in that thing.
I want to try something with you that usually we do with corporate CEOs. What is your job in five words or less?
Wow. And then if I said my job is
no, that doesn't
two,
count. Just, you know, you can just words. No, you can go straight into it. That's fine.
Okay, I'm gonna lose some connective tissue words.
That's fine. We understand that.
Create comedy makes you feel.
Create comedy makes you feel. Okay.
That's five, right?
Create comedy makes you feel, period.
Create comedy makes you feel. I want the word which, but I'm going to assume that people know that it belongs there.
They do now.
Maybe there's a way to reorder it. Make feeling comedy which good.
No, you were better the first time. Judd Apatow, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
He came close, though, didn't he? We've got an excerpt from Sick in the Head on our website. It's marketplace.org. Also, a couple of pieces of tape from some of those interviews that Judd did when he was a kid with the likes of Jay Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, and Chris Rock. Check them out. Final note on the way out today. You'll want to know why people pay so much attention to Carl Icahn, the corporate raider or activist investor shareholder, depending on how you want to characterize him. People pay so much attention because he knows what he is doing. This morning, Icahn tweeted out that he has closed his position in Netflix. That is, sold off the last of his stock. He bought 10% of that company 3 years ago at $58 a share. It topped $700 a pop this morning. Icahn walks away with $993 million. How about that? All righty, got to go. The Dow off 178 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ dropped 37 points, 0.7%. The S&P 500 also 0.7%. Works out to 15 points there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. Thanks today to the staff here at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you back in L.A. tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.